Blog Talk Radio.
Crucified for no sins.
And welcome everybody to the Dragon's Lair. And that was Pantera. As most of you probably know already, they are another Texas band. Rest in peace, Dimebag Darrell. Tonight's topic, the importance of knowing about Texas Continued, Part 5. Please see the Blog Talk Radio show page for details or any questions. For the record, today is January 14th, 2013, on our screwed-up Christian calendar. The sun is at 24 degrees Capricorn. Again, I have no personal website or blog. If you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com, and that is magus_18@geocities.com. If you want to be on my e-list, send me a blank email just saying subscribe, or you can just write me. I can't guarantee I can answer all of my emails, but I will read all of them. There will be no calls tonight. And the cat is in the chair here with me. Dog is out in the front yard. Hopefully he won't be any kind of a problem. He is, starts barking at a cat, waking everybody up. I'll have to play a song or something. That's presuming I'm not playing something already. So, anyway, well, I've had somebody write me this last week or so, and I'm not going to say where they're from, but they were inquiring about the possibility of moving to Texas. And so I wrote him back, you know, saying, well, you know, the easiest thing probably for me to do would probably be to try and, you know, answer it to a certain extent in one of my shows. You know, that would actually probably be more beneficial to, you know, the rest of the listeners, etc. And, you know, and this is not going to certainly answer all of the questions, but it will at least be somewhat of a start, and then my personal message to them would be, you know, absorb everything that I'm going to try to tell you tonight, and then, you know, any questions after that, and after you've done some of your own research based on what I say tonight, you know, write me back. I'm just trying to, I mean, it's a very complicated issue. You say you want to move to Texas. Well, what do you do for a living? Do you want to live in the city? Do you want to live in the country? You want to live in the mountains? You want to live in the hills? You want to live in flatland, the woods, or the Gulf Coast? You like the beach? You like the lake? You like to swim, fish, go nude? Yeah, whatever the case may be. This is a big place. But what I'm going to do here is say some things and kind of go down a list of some of the cities here. You know, if you're a white-collar worker, you can pretty much find a job in any decent-sized city. The larger the city, the easier to find the job, though. You know, unless there's certain skills, though, that are in demand in a particular area. You know, if you're a blue-collar worker, that's a little bit different story. You know, it. You know, most of your small construction here is done by illegals. You know, your commercial construction has some illegals there as well. But you know, there's non-illegals. You know, in the commercial sites, you know, they can't have all illegals on a commercial site. The quality standards are different, and the insurance and everything else. You know, so. But you know, try to be a white guy and go build a house. You know, or wire a house or be a plumber or whatever, you know, unless you're in a, you know, something like a garage door installer or, you know, something specific, you know, it's going to be hard to get in. But, you know, in Houston, for example, it's petrochemical and a lot of oil refining. We got, you know, the ship channel. You know, I mean, it's the largest port in the country in tonnage. For foreign tonnage, you know, et cetera. And there's plenty of related industries. You know, before I got into architecture and structural engineering, You know, I've been working since I was probably 16, and for the better part of the time from when I started working until I got out of high school, I worked full-time and went to school, and I did like warehouse jobs, shipping, receiving jobs. You know, I worked at a place that shipped oil field supplies to all of the local cities. Of course, this was before the oil bust. And, of course, that was a planned bust. I don't think that we'll see anything like that again. You know, it's all pretty steady. But, you know, if you're a, you know, if you're a draftsman or an engineer, I mean, there's petrochemical engineering. You know, there's related structural piping, pressure vessels. I mean, you name it. There's just all sorts of things that you can do. You know, if you're an IT guy, any big city, and in particular Austin. Austin is a Silicon Valley. All the California companies are moving to Texas to get out from under the burden of their taxes and all the other problems that they have there. And Austin is sort of a special case, I guess. There's so many people from everywhere moving there right now, and the cost of living is gone up as a result. You know, you got people in California who, in New York, who have sold their overpriced real estate and coming down here and buying up regular price real estate, and then that drives the price up of the other real estate around it, and so prices just keep going up and up and up and up. You know, right now San Antonio is probably the hottest market right now, if you want to use that word market. San Antonio is booming, put it that way. And a lot of it is gas related. Just south, and I believe it's southwest, and just south of there, there's a lot of drilling for gas going on right now. But you know, there's, you know, where there is industry, there's got to be support. And you know, I could get a job in most of the places in Texas myself, but let me clear my throat. But you know, a lot depends on where you want to live too. You know, on my Blog Talk Radio page, I put a map up, and if you take your mouse and put the cursor over it, it will pause. You can look at it, and you can see the major regions of the state. Let me bring it up on my screen here so I can go over it. You know, you'll look along by the Gulf of Mexico. You have the Gulf Coast. You know, that's just coastal plains. And, you know, basically Houston all the way to the east towards Louisiana is what's called bio country. Now, a lot of people don't know what a bio is. Well, bio is not as big as a river, but a hell of a lot bigger than a creek. Okay? And bio country pretty much runs from roughly about Houston eastward all the way to Mobile, Alabama. And but the rest of the Gulf Coast is just low plains, low elevation plains. And most of the Gulf Coast has got barrier islands. And there's a bunch of bays, Galveston, Trinity being the largest. And in Galveston, you got Galveston Island. And then you got South Padre Island. And then you've got various peninsulas. You know, Bolivar Peninsula is over near, over by Galveston. You know, you're just going to have to get on, get a map, whether it's online or get a physical one and look at it. You know, I suggest both if you're that serious about coming to Texas. You know, and if you look in East Texas, it's piney woods. And it's all mainly pine trees, just all pine trees. There's other trees mixed in, but it's called the Big Thicket. And there's just so many. We don't have these huge trees like they have in California. You know, these pine trees, you know, they're maybe about 18 to 24 inches in diameter. You know, and they go about 30, 40 feet tall, but they're so thick. You know, it's hard to see through them, you know, for a distance. And in the piney woods, that's probably the most conservative area of Texas. And when I say conservative, I mean Christian conservative. You know, there's a lot of Bible thumpers there. And, you know, if you read, I believe his first name is Thomas Chittum's book, Civil War II. And the section that he wrote on Texas was that you could pretty much take a line from Houston to Dallas, which is basically along Interstate 45. And most of the blacks were east of that. Well, some of them have managed to move, you know, move westward. And, of course, you know, the big cities, you know, Houston and Dallas, Fort Worth, they have blacks in them. And San Antonio used to not have any blacks. And, you know, Austin's got blacks now, too. And there are some in the Triangle, but not that many. Most of them are still where I just described. And you're going to find illegal aliens, you know, all over, but in particular the southern part of the state and then the far west, you know, and of course the big cities. And but you're going to find them anywhere. And that's pretty much all over the country now. You know, you just can't get away from them. But the South Texas Plains is, you know, there's that's called the Valley. You know, there's mountains on the other side of the Rio Grande River. And that's the most commercial agricultural area. When I say commercial, meaning, you know, bought people. You can have a garden anywhere in pretty much in Texas as you want. But, you know, I mean, there's citrus trees, you know, and cotton. You know, all sorts of vegetables are grown down there. It's warm. They rarely ever get a freeze. And it's pretty hot too, actually, during the summer. It's really humid down there. But I don't recommend necessarily moving in that area unless you just have a specific skill related to that, to what I just described. Now, along the Gulf Coast, you've got some towns. You know, you got Brownsville right there on the border, and across from Matamoros, Mexico, on the Bravo. It's the very bottom tip of the state. And Corpus Christi is, it's up a little ways, not half. It's about two-thirds of the distance from Houston to Mexico, one-third towards Mexico. And that's a pretty decent-sized city. It's, you know, over 300,000 people there. You could probably find some work there, but you're gonna have more Mexicans there than you will. And if you lived a little further north, you know, there is a naval base there. It's closer to deep water. During the 80s, the U.S. Navy was wanting to put a base in the Gulf, and they were trying to choose between Corpus or Galveston, and they chose Corpus because it's just a lot closer to deep water. In fact, you know, you get down towards Corpus and then further south, the Gulf of Mexico is just beautiful. Now, don't get me wrong. It's when there's a hurricane, everything that's ever been dumped washes up on the beaches. Let me light this cigarette. During Hurricane Ike, 2008, or Hurricane Kike, the whole Gulf Coast just got littered with stuff that had been dumped in the Gulf. I mean, that was just a huge hurricane. It wasn't that strong, but it was huge, and there was a big storm surge. Storm surge was really a bigger hurricane in power, or stronger hurricane in power than what Ike actually was. But anyway, college students love to go down to South Padre Island during spring break and Corpus, but mainly South Padre. I remember when South Padre was basically people just pitched a tent. It's all built up with hotels and motels and so on and so forth, very touristy. And also too, the South Texas Plains there, you'll start seeing cactus everywhere. You'll see it even right along the Gulf Coast too when you get south of Corpus. But you know, there's cactus all over the place, pretty much in most of the southwest and west part of the state. Now, if you'll notice where Houston is, it's in the Gulf Coast region. You look at Dallas and Fort Worth, and that's in the prairies and lakes. And Austin and San Antonio are right there in the hill country. And if you're around Austin, you're pretty close to just about everything that, you know, every part of the state. I mean, you got to drive. Don't get me wrong. You got to drive to get anywhere in this state. You know, if I want to go to a lake, you know, you're talking 75 miles. Okay, you know, now to get to the Gulf, about 50, depending on where you're at in Houston. You know, so there's lakes all over the state. They're all except one lake are man-made in Texas, and but there's plenty of them, and there's a whole lot of lakes around Dallas-Fort Worth, and they've probably got more in that area than any other part of the state, and there's some lakes around Austin. And anyway, I've been thinking about trying to move kind of between Houston and Austin. If you look on that map, it's in that prairies and lakes section there. And so if you were to move roughly between halfway between Houston and Austin, you know, you got the Gulf Coast real close, and you got the Piney Woods, and you're already in the prairies and lakes. The hill country is right there. You know, I don't know that I'd have a real reason to go to the South Texas Plains, but, you know. And basically the prairies and lakes are the low plains. The Panhandle Plains are the high plains. And by the time you get to Dallas, Fort Worth, and that area, Abilene, which is west of Fort Worth, you know, you're probably, that's all low plains. In the hill country, it's all rolling hills with, you know, like mesquite, you know, small trees, shrubs. But it's pretty, you know. I mean, from a distance without knowing what, you know, now being able to identify the trees, it would look like just any other area that's got rolling mountains, like, you know, maybe foothills of the Ozarks or foothills of the Appalachians, you know, that kind of thing. They're not really big hills, but they're the biggest hills in Texas aside from the mountains in West Texas. You know, the Big Bend region is sort of a semi-desert. There are places there that are actually desert, but not like you have in Arizona and New Mexico and northern Mexico. But it's like at the edge of it. Cigarette didn't stay lit. Hold on. In the Big Bend area, you know, it's kind of flat until you get to different parts of it. You know, it's like all of a sudden these mountains just appear out of nowhere. You know, where the Big Bend actually is in the Bravo, you know, there's that's a national park, pretty big one too, all mountains, very pretty. The tallest mountain in the state is on the border between New Mexico and Texas, just due east of El Paso. It's the Guadalupe Mountains. But between there and the Big Bend, you've got several different mountain ranges. You get over towards El Paso, and I wouldn't recommend being over that area. You know, if you wanted to be just east of that area a little ways, you know, 100 miles, 150 miles or so, that'd be fine. But El Paso is right across the river from the city of Juarez, which is about 1.5 million people at least. And it would probably... You probably wouldn't be able to keep a vehicle there, put it that way. So it would, you know, if you had a decent vehicle, it might would, you know, it'd probably wind up eventually being stolen and then driven across the border. So, and that would be another reason not to live down in the South Texas Plains area as well. But, you know, that can happen anywhere. You know, I heard a story about somebody who spent the night in Memphis. Of course, Memphis, I hear, is not really a very good place. But their vehicle got stolen there, and they never heard again. And it probably was sent to Mexico. So, you know. And that's Memphis, Tennessee. So. But, you know, then you got the in the Panhandle, that's, you know, all high plains, you know, Amarillo, Lubbock. And now in Central Texas, there was a lot of German settlements. In fact, I've got an article I'm going to read on that here in just a second. And a lot of Germans migrated here, and so you've got some towns that have got some German names. A lot of people still speak some sort of a dialect of German, and there's a lot of German festivals in that area as well every year. In fact, let me go ahead and just bring that article up. It's rather interesting. It's kind of a drifting off of the topic a little bit, but it's not a real long article. This came out of the Scotsman, ironically, of all places. And this is actually something I was never even familiar with. As much as I know about my state and my history, I did not know this. And Eric found it and pointed it out to me, sent me the link. The link's no longer valid. But, you know, it makes sense when you know the rest of the history. It says, Prince uncovers 19th century plot to make Texas German. And this is written by someone named Alan Hall for the Scotsman in Berlin. It says, an extraordinary 19th century plot by German nobility to take over Texas and turn it into a German country has been uncovered by a historian looking through old records of some of Germany's oldest families. Prince Hans von Sachsen-Altenburg discovered that in the 1840s, when Texas was still a republic, the nobles managed to raise a small fortune from the state of Prussia under cover of an economic club known as the Adelsverein, or Association of Nobility. The association used the money to send almost 8,000 members to Texas on the pretext they were fleeing political persecution or poverty. But according to the historian, many were wealthy aristocrats and military officers planning to take control of the republic. Says they used the cliched image of impoverished immigrants flooding into the New World as cover to send thousands of their nobles, generals, and soldiers to Texas to put their scheme into action, said Prince Sachsen-Altenburg. He claims the man who hatched the plan to turn Texas Teutonic, as if somehow all whites are not Teutonic. He claims the man who hatched the plan to turn Texas Teutonic was Prince Carl von Solms-Braunfels. And there is a town called New Braunfels, and by the way, a German field marshal and a blood relation of Queen Victoria, who had been hardened by European wars. At the time, the bankrupt republic, referring to Texas, was protected by only a few hundred Texas Rangers and had fewer than 40,000 people on its land. As part of plans to win logistical aid from Britain, Prince Solms-Braunfels courted Victoria's favor for a new Germany in the West, claiming British economic interest in California and Mexico were threatened by a westward moving United States. And I will get into those subjects at a later date. And those are very valid. According to the historian, the solution was to establish a German state of Texas. From Europe, the Adelsverein had purchased more than 3 million acres of Texan land, but the group soon discovered it was unsuitable for farming and was occupied by some 10,000 warring Comanche Indians. Oops. Under Prince Solms-Braunfels' direction, the Germans established a series of forts such as Nassau, New Braunfels, and Karlshafen, cities that still bear their German names. To complement weaponry brought with them, correspondence sent back to Germany by Prince Solms-Braunfels in 1844 urgently called for more heavy artillery and rifles. Arms were sent over labeled only as personal baggage, said Prince Sachsen-Altenburg. Hence, it was not always documented at the U.S. end. The prince added that Britain considered sending military equipment overland from California. Messages between Lord Aberdeen, the foreign secretary, and the new German community were handled by William Kennedy, the British consul in Galveston. Unfortunately for the venture, it was this course of communication that ultimately proved their undoing and forced the U.S. to speed up its annexation of Texas, the prince said. The government messenger was instructed to hand over the correspondence personally to the British consul, but instead of that, he was met by a U.S. spy who drank him under the table and intercepted the information that was then sent to the White House. Within weeks, James K. Polk, the then U.S. president, sent forces to the Texas border, and Congress voted to annex the republic. Now, actually, that had already happened before Polk became president. That was under John Tyler when that occurred. And Polk had been elected, but this happened before Polk came into office. So that little correction to this article here. Anyway, it says, while Adelsverein diehards still aspired to establish a colony, financial and logistical support was largely withdrawn, and the venture foundered. That's what it says, foundered. Should say floundered, I guess, several years later. Let me clear my throat. So anyway, back to the subject at hand here. One thing to consider, you know, no matter where you live, you know, and especially in the city, you know, if you've got children, you know, you've got to be careful where they go to school, you know, especially if you're in the city. You know, I would not be living where I live now, 2 miles from downtown Houston, with children unless I could afford to put them in a private school. And that's pretty much all there is to it. And if you live in some of the suburbs, you know, they're depending on which suburb you're in, it's going to be better. You know, when I was growing up, my parents moved us out to the edge of town to get me into a better school district. And so, you know, but even some of the suburbs, depending upon the level of income of the neighborhoods, you know, that makes a huge difference on who's going to be going to the school. But, you know, that's a huge consideration. And, you know, it's, let's see here. Let me just go down the list of some of these cities. And this is from Wikipedia. Just go to list of cities in Texas by population. You know, Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, Austin, Fort Worth. Okay, well, Houston has got more people from, okay, well, let me put it this way. Houston's got a share of blacks. It's got a share of Mexicans. But Houston has probably got somebody here from everywhere else on the planet, okay? And I'm sure DFW does, but Houston probably has a little bit larger percentage. And Dallas may be a little bit more wider than Houston is, but they do have their share of blacks and Mexicans. Believe me, they do. And actually, in the 70s, Dallas had more blacks than Houston did. Houston probably had more Mexicans. San Antonio has, since the late 70s, early 80s, I guess, it's probably been mostly Mexican. But these are Mexicans who are here legally. They've been here for, you know, several generations. Most of them actually think they're white, you know. You go to San Antonio, San Antonio's not a bad town, you know. Now, if you're into partying, just about any place, you know, unless you're just in the boonies somewhere. But, you know, San Antonio's got a lot of good places to go drinking. You know, San Antonio is, you know, you go there and you look around and you see all these Mexicans, but, you know, they're middle class, upper, lower, middle, you know, et cetera. And it's, you'd be surprised, okay? And I'm not making excuses for them, all right? But that's just the way it is. Now, if you do personally have a taste for Mexican women, there are a lot of beautiful Mexican women in San Antonio, okay? Now, I'm not advocating that, but I'm just saying, hey, that's the way it is. There are a lot of beautiful Mexican women in San Antonio. You know, I look at the Mexican women here. They are nothing compared to the women in San Antonio, all right? But San Antonio's got a lot of military bases. San Antonio is the second largest city. not second largest metropolitan area. This is just a list of the main cities, not the metro areas. But San Antonio is booming. San Antonio has plenty of room to grow. Houston has plenty of room to grow. It's not surrounded by suburbs. Most of Houston suburbs, it tends to swallow up. Dallas is totally surrounded by suburbs. It has no more room to grow out. It can only get denser or grow up. Dallas, I don't know if it's Dallas County or just the city of Dallas itself, but it's technically, I think it's dry. But the way they get around it is you buy a membership to a club. And so you can drink by being a member. And actually, the area I'm living here in Houston is called the Heights. And it once was its own city before Houston swallowed it up. It's part of the city of Houston now. But for whatever reason, you know, it's still dry from when it was its own city. And there's all sorts of liquor stores all around the area. And by the way, we do not have state-owned liquor stores. They're all privately owned. You can buy alcohol till in the liquor stores, I think, till 9 every night, except for Sunday. They're closed on Sunday. And I don't know what remember what time they open. If you got to go get it that early, then you got a drinking problem, probably. Unless you're throwing a party, I guess. But anyway, you know, most of the rest of the state is not like that. There are some counties, though, that are still dry from the, you know, back when Prohibition, you know, like Lufkin, Texas, the county it's in, last I heard it's still dry. So you got to go to the next county to buy your alcohol. But, you know, that's in East Texas. And that's what I mean by Christian conservative, okay? There are plenty of other places that are conservative. They're just not Christian conservative, or they're, you know, if they are, they're just very lax, put it that way. But Austin is the most liberal place in the state of Texas, hands down. It's also home to the University of Texas, and I don't know if it still is, but University of Texas is the largest, has the largest student population in the country. Last I heard, could be different now, but there's a lot of money in the University of Texas. Dallas has SMU, Fort Worth has TCU, Dallas is Southern Methodist University, TCU is Texas Christian University. Yeah, that Bible Belt, that was back from when they were at one time extremely conservative. They have lightened up. They are certainly more still a little bit more conservative than say Houston is. Houston is pretty liberal, but nothing like Austin except for certain areas, okay? But you're going to find liberals, you know, it's salt and pepper all over the place, okay? Fort Worth is probably still more of a traditional Texas city than any of the other big cities. And northern part of Fort Worth, you know, the Richland Hills area, that's probably the place to be if you're going to be in Fort Worth. Dallas, you want to be north of Dallas. And Houston, generally, you can be in any direction and be in a good neighborhood. Okay, yeah, it's salt and pepper between good and bad everywhere. Okay, and Houston is just so spread out. Okay, and then after Fort Worth, you got El Paso, and you know, El Paso's got like 672,000 people. So, I mean, it's a pretty big city, but unless you got business out there, I see no reason to go there. And they're in Mountain Time, by the way. It's the only part of Texas that's not in Central. Number 7 is Arlington. That's a suburb of Dallas, Fort Worth. Corpus Christi, I mentioned earlier. Plano, that's a suburb of Dallas. Laredo, you don't want to be around Laredo. Unless you're in the oil business, but you know, across the border, that's where they're having all the drug wars going on, or at least one of the areas in Mexico where they are. Lubbock's in the Panhandle. That would be, say, conservative, not like East Texas, but you know, you're and it gets cold in the Panhandle, really cold compared to the rest of the state. Garland is a suburb of Dallas, that's number 12. Irving suburb. Dallas-Fort Worth. Amarillo's in the Panhandle. Grand Prairie's in the suburb of Dallas-Fort Worth. Brownsville, I mentioned them. They're down the border with Mexico across from Matamoros. I don't remember how big Matamoros is, but Matamoros developed during the war during the War of Northern Aggression. It was used for smuggling to get goods into the South. But it's a shithole. But, you know, Brownsville is probably a decent little town. Now, Pasadena, number 17, that's a suburb of Houston, our largest suburb. McKinney is a suburb of Dallas. Mesquite is a suburb of Dallas. McAllen, that's down in the valley. Killeen, that's like near Fort Hood, southwest of Fort Worth. Frisco's like northeast of Dallas, and that's a growing area, probably good. Waco, yeah, there's parts of Waco that are okay. That's not too far from Fort Hood either. Carrollton is a suburb of Dallas. Denton is just north of Dallas and Fort Worth. Midland, that's like if you looked on a map and went to southeast New Mexico and drew a line, you know, to the river, to the shortest point, that's roughly where that is. Abilene is like west of Fort Worth, about 100 miles. Beaumont, that's about 100 miles east of Houston. Round Rock's north of Austin. Odessa is out where Midland is in West Texas. Wichita Falls, that's along the Oklahoma border north of Dallas. Tyler, kind of southeast of Dallas. Richardson, that's a suburb of Richardson and Louisville. Suburbs of Dallas or Fort Worth. And College Station, that's kind of like where I was talking about moving, but just a little further north of where I'm thinking of. Pearland's a suburb of Houston. San Angelo, that's kind of like in the middle of nowhere. That's like between Abilene and Midland, Odessa. The Woodlands, practically all white, very upscale, north of Houston. 93,000 people. You know, most of these are not big cities, but they're not little towns either. You know, the Woodlands, 38th largest city in Texas, 93,000 people. Allen, I'm not sure where Allen is. League City, suburb of Houston. Sugarland, suburb of Houston. Longview. Longview's a good place. Longview's about 100 miles east of Dallas along Interstate 20. Very white. Fairly conservative, but not overly conservative. You know, there might be some overly Christian conservatives there. Edinburgh's down the valley. Mission, I think, is somewhere in somewhere west of west of where I'm at. I don't remember exactly. Bryan is near College Station. That's where Texas A&M University is. And by the way, that's like the area I was talking about, but just north of it. Back to the college thing while I'm thinking about it. So Texas A&M is there. Baylor University, which is very Baptist, is in Waco. And Houston has Rice University and University of Houston. University of Houston is like Rome or something. You know, there's someone there from everywhere. Used to not be that way. My father graduated from University of Houston. Now, I had an uncle who graduated from Rice. Rice is like the Harvard of the South, very small, very elite school. And I think it's a private college. But anyway, Far Texas, I don't know where that is. It doesn't ring a bell. Number 47, Temple, you know, that's like going, like it's not too far from Waco. Missouri City's suburb of Houston. Flower Mound, that's somewhere near Dallas. Harlingen's down the valley. See, that's like 50 cities right there. And I didn't even get to like North Richland Hills, Conroe, New Braunfels, Mansfield, Spring, Port Arthur, Pflugerville, you know, San Marcos. You know, I mean, the top, okay, number 66 on this list has 50,000 people in it. So, let me clear my throat. So, you get the idea. You know, there's a, let me give you an example. Fort Smith, Arkansas. I don't even think Fort Smith, Arkansas would be It's it would be like maybe in the 40 or so. So I think it's like would be number 40 if it was in this list. You know, it's not a big city, but it's not a small town. You know, so you know anything under 100,000, unless it's a suburb of a big city, kind of falls into that category of not a big city, but not a small town. But even number 66 on this list is not a small town. So, you know, what is it you want to do? You want to raise a family? Well, you know, where do you want to be? What do you like to do for entertainment? What do you like to do for recreation? You know, so on and so forth. Let's see here. We've got a... All right, I've gotten about 50 minutes into the show. I was kind of unsure how long I was going to spend talking on this topic, but I think those who really have a serious interest in possibly moving here needed to hear all that. So let me light this smoke. Now, what I was going to say here, something before I forget, a couple of things. Texas saved France's wine industry. I don't remember what year. There were major droughts in France, and people had tried to start growing grapes here in Texas, and they still do. We have Texas wine here, just like California has theirs. I don't know if ours is quite as good as California's, but certainly probably not as good as France, but they transplanted plants that were growing in Texas, which came from France in the first place, and sent them back to France. And so if you're drinking any French wine, ultimately it may have passed through Texas in the process. Now, one other thing before I forget, there's this word Tejano. You know, the like during the Mexican War, the Texans in the U.S. Army were known as Los Diablos Tejanos, the Devil Texans. Tejano means Texan. Well, there's been variations of the meaning of that word over time, and I just wanted to clarify this now before we go any further, because it's going to make a difference in the shows in the future. When Texas was being settled by Anglos in the first place, the Mexicans that lived here were called Tejanos. And then after Texas won its independence, most of the Mexicans got ran out. Not right away, but I've mentioned it before that, you know, it was sort of multicultural at first, and then eventually there were racial divisions, and no need to explain how that happens. But so during the war between Mexico and the United States, the Texans were known as Tejanos. Now, today, a Tejano is a Mexican who is a U.S. citizen who lives in Texas. Now, just FYI, the Mexicans in Mexico do not like most of the Mexicans who live in the United States. They see them as traitors. Now, of course, the illegal aliens, they go back and forth, but they're not actually citizens, and so they still maintain their traditional values. Don't want to learn English, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. No need to explain that. So, but anyway, there's been variations of the meaning of that word, and that's going to come up. And so I wanted to be sure and mention that. Now, after the last show that I did, I had saved a list of topics, and I read them off at the end of it and said I was going to try to cover them as time goes on, and I am, and I've already started working on some of them. However, I can't find my list, so I'm going to have to go back and listen to the end of that last show and write down a new list. Luckily, I read them all out loud. So, but one thing I did do was get a little bit more information on Richard McLaren. And there was that, the guy who did that, lecture on the not so brief history of Texas. You know, he was talking about some of the past Republic of Texas movements, how they were not treated very nicely, and then now the climate has changed, et cetera, et cetera. and it seems to have. But he mentioned in there that, you know, McLaren was not a wacko, and the press just made him out to be as such, and et cetera, et cetera. But there was sort of a standoff in West Texas, and I found on YouTube someone who had made recordings off of the news reports. Apparently they pieced it together kind of in a timeline, and I managed to catch the audio on that, and there's not really a whole lot to see, you know. You need to hear it, though, to see how the media made him look. But some of the things that he appears to have said, he does kind of come off as a wacko. But I don't know if that was his actual voice response at that time, or if they just created it using other recordings, you know. You know, that can be done. Someone could take pieces of my show and put together whole sentences and paragraphs and make it sound as if I said that. So I don't know if that was done then or not. This was in the, like, I think 96, 97 when that happened. And I'm going to play that here at some point. I may just do a show where I include that, some other recordings. That's another thing I wanted to mention. I've been playing a lot of recordings of stuff that I think is important. And it kind of saves my effort, you know, makes my effort a little easier. But I still have some more. But until I get to once I play those and I get to the U.S.-Mexican War, I'm going to be doing a lot of piecing together of things out of books to convey. And I'm going to get into some real, real detailed information. And I know I keep saying that, but there is so much here that has to be kind of dealt with up front to get everybody onto the same page of where they need to be. So it's not a total, it's not starting out just totally blank. And, you know, having a good kind of overview of the history and some of the events is really important going into it. And what I've been doing since the last show is I have been on eBay. I've been buying books that I have in storage. That way I don't have to spend time in storage trying to find them. I don't know which box they're in, and I'm not going to spend time doing it. I can get them on eBay for so cheap that, you know, it's not like I'm going to Barnes & Noble or whatever and paying full price like the ones I have in storage. And I bought books that I didn't have before in my list, and I have a nice little collection now of Texas history, and I have a very nice collection of U.S.-Mexican War history. And on the latter, I have one that was written 1 year after the war ended. I have another one that was written about 1900. And I have some recent stuff, too. But the what I've got that's recent is, it's a little bit more fair. You know, there are two sides to this issue between Texas and Mexico and the United States and Mexico. You know, I'm going to thoroughly refute most of their issues, but there will be other times, by the way, that I will be playing some audio, but not quite to the level that I have been playing it. So anyway, I just kind of wanted to get all that information out there. And I think what I'm going to do now is I'm going to play a song, and I'll figure out what I'm going to do next while the song is playing. And so let me get back over to the studio here, and I'll play a song, and I'll be right back.
rhythm to my song. And if you want to sing along, it's about where I belong. Texas. Sometimes far into the night, and until the morning light, I pray with all my might to be a Texan. It's where I want to be. It's the only place for me, where my spirit can be free.
And if you recognize the voice, that was Willie Nelson, who is from Texas. So what I'm going to do next, I've got two clips here of the Battle of the Alamo. You know, there were videos on YouTube. But, you know, you really don't have to see the video. You know, the thing about doing it the way I'm doing it here, you can kind of go on about your business and just listen, and you can still absorb what needs to be, but you don't have to go to YouTube, find it, make a special effort, wait for everything to load. You know, I'm kind of doing the work for you here. And I've got one that's a little bit more politically correct than the other, but still informative. It's worth hearing. And one is a little bit longer than the other. One is about a little over 45 minutes. The other one is almost an hour and 20 minutes, I think. And the longer one is the one that's a little bit more politically correct. But I want to go ahead and kind of get these clips out of the way. And I think you'll still get something out of it. And if you're following along with me, you're already interested in the subject. And so I'm going to play the longer one. And then we'll see how much time is left after that. And how awake I still am, and we'll see what happens after that. I really kind of didn't go into this show with anything set. I just kind of looked at all the possibilities, and there were certain things I definitely wanted to say and information I wanted to get out. And then it's like, okay, after that, I've got this to do, that, or this, you know, take your pick. And so some of it is based on time. And this will definitely go over the two-hour mark. And if you want to call in and hear that way live, you can, or just download it and catch the end of it. But I'm going to go ahead and play this. And I know some of you will listen to the end of 2 hours, download it, and then listen to the rest of it. That's fine, too, as long as you pay attention and listen. So I'm going to go ahead and play this one, and I'll be back when it's over.
Mm-hmm. It began in the pre-dawn darkness of March 6, 1836. Mexican General Santa Anna ordered an assault force of 1,800 men to unleash its fury on a tiny band of Texans defending a fort called the Alamo. Most of us have heard of the battle. Heroes like Davy Crockett and Jim Bowie going down in a blaze of glory. Americans against Mexicans, good versus evil, freedom versus tyranny. But the real history behind the battle is far different. On one hand, it tells how Texas became part of the United States. On the other, it reveals how Texas was torn away from Mexico.
To some people, the Alamo is an emblem of American aggression against Mexico. To other people, the Alamo is an emblem of heroic self-sacrifice for a larger cause.
They claim that they're fighting against tyranny, they're fighting against injustice, they're fighting against oppression.
In general, Mexicans see the events that took place in Texas as the first part of an American expansion.
And it may have been a victory for Santa Anna, but I think it was an even greater victory for the humanity of those defenders.
In the United States, the Alamo has become obscured by myth, which complicates what really happened here. For example, at the time Jim Bowie died at the Alamo, he was a Mexican citizen, not an American. And many of the Alamo defenders were born and bred Mexican natives, not Americans who came down from the north. So what has evolved into a race war was really something quite different.
People tend to view the Battle of the Alamo as a clash of cultures, and it's not that. It's a battle that's part of a larger civil war. So the issues at the Alamo are not issues of race, but they're issues of competing political systems.
The Texas Revolution was rewritten as a war between white and brown, between good and evil, between a civilized race and an uncivilized race.
When I was in third grade, we took a field trip to the Alamo. As we exit out the back of the Alamo, my best friend nudged me and said, "You killed them, you and the other Mexicans." And that story stayed with me for a long time. And it's not that I didn't realize I was Mexican, you know, I never doubted that. I just didn't realize it was a liability in the eyes of my best friend.
The Alamo story even has its own vocabulary. A Texian is an Anglo-American who immigrated to Texas. A Tejano is a native Mexican Texan. The ranks of the Alamo defenders included both. There are other more common words in the Alamo dictionary as well. Freedom, honor, and sacrifice are trumpeted loudly in telling the Alamo story, especially in the American view. But listen to the Mexican storytellers, and you will also hear slavery, speculation, or treason. The differences arise in part because so many accounts emphasize just the Battle of the Alamo itself. But that milestone is only part of a much larger story. This cross-cultural symbol was originally a mission called San Antonio de Valero. Built beginning in 1724 outside the town of San Antonio de Bejar, as an outpost to help Christianize Indians when Mexico was still a colony of Spain. The mission itself was a series of buildings within a walled compound. The missionaries planned to build a beautiful church as a symbol of their allegiance to God. Construction was started but never completed. The roof of the unfinished church remained open to the sky when Spain closed the mission in 1794 because local Indians were, by then, well integrated into the community. A few townspeople took up residence in some of the buildings, and the compound acquired a new name when a unit of Spanish soldiers began using the site as well. The troop came from the Mexican town of Alamo de Paras, and from them, the mission became known as the Alamo. It was 1803, and the forces leading to the landmark battle were beginning to build.
it's important when you're looking at the Alamo to be able to put it into some sort of continuum, because otherwise it's an event that really doesn't make much sense. Why is there a battle? Why does San Antonio have this Texan fort? Why does Santa Ana come there? And so you really have to look at the events leading up to it to get the significance of why the battle's fought.
Important to the events leading up to the Alamo were the controversial actions of filibusters. Today, the word means a prolonged Senate debate, but the Alamo definition is far different.
A filibuster is a private armed individual who engages in a military activity, a military expedition against the domain of a country then at peace with the United States.
In the ever-increasing hunger for new land, the territories of Florida and Texas were targets for American filibusters, who fought for independence in both places beginning in the year 1800, when they were still parts of the Spanish Empire. In the real history of these epic events, filibusters and the Alamo go hand in hand.
The truth of the Alamo and the truth of the Texas Revolution is that it's a filibustering expedition. Here you have Americans who, against the official policy of their government, they are crossing over the border and they are fighting for Texas independence.
To Mexican history, the filibusters were rabble-rousers. To American history, they were freedom fighters. There is some truth to each side of the story. But the roots of the conflict were much more complex and would all come together at the Alamo. The bloodletting that would erupt at the Alamo on March 6, 1836, was the result of more than a half century of conflicts over land, borders, slavery, and politics between Americans and the neighboring territories of Spain.
It's virtually impossible to separate so-called pocketbook issues, land sales, land values, slaves, economic issues, from patriotic and political issues as well, because they're always inextricably intertwined. The man who's fighting for his country is also fighting for himself. So in a way, patriotism is a kind of enlightened selfishness, and that is certainly the case with the Alamo.
Since its early years, the United States had the urge to expand its borders, tending to covet the lands of its neighbors, especially the Spanish territories of Florida and Texas.
Americans look at the Spanish territories not necessarily as permanent features on the political map, and either legitimately or illegitimately, that they will become part of the United States.
It wasn't only a hunger for land. American presidents from Washington to Monroe feared invasion from the European powers lurking just over U.S. borders.
There is a British neighbor to the north, and there is a Spanish neighbor to the south and to the west. Those European powers did not look favorably on the American Republic with its republican ideas. There's always the concern that these European monarchical powers will be conspiring behind the American back to end the American experiment. So, for all of these presidents, the best thing to do is remove these European powers, to remove the source of trouble, to remove the source of friction.
In 1803, President Thomas Jefferson negotiated the Louisiana Purchase with France. The new land gave the United States a common border with Spanish Texas. But the boundaries of the Louisiana Territory were only vaguely defined, so disputes over ownership of Texas began quickly. With the rapidly growing USA just next door, Spain felt the pressure.
Texas always served as a remote outpost of the Spanish Empire. Spain never had enough men in Texas to effectively garrison the region, nor to effectively control the region.
And Texas was a rich prize. The land was immense, with broad pastures, lush rivers, and a warm climate ideal for the agricultural society of the time. Americans crossed the border illegally to settle the empty territory. In 1813, American filibusters joined with Spanish colonists opposing the rule of Spain in Texas. They had secretly negotiated with Secretary of State James Monroe. The rebels, Monroe believed, would deliver their new territory to the United States.
Monroe is willing to make deals on the side. Money, supplies are being funneled into East Texas. The U.S. government is going to be actively involved in a private context. Yet, when it becomes public, the U.S. government is going to deny its involvement.
Monroe, however, did not expect the Texas rebels to declare their own independence. They called themselves the Green Flag Republic, and aid from Washington evaporated.
It becomes pretty apparent to Monroe that this is not going to become a part of the American constellation, that it's going to be a free and independent republic. That being the case, perhaps we need not to provide as much support to them as we had promised.
Without U.S. support, the rebels could not prevail, and the Spanish quickly crushed the Green Flag Republic.
The Republican forces are defeated, but they're not just defeated, they are annihilated. There are about 400 prisoners that are rounded up and are executed.
The policy was one of no quarter. The enemy annihilated. No prisoners taken. Among the Spanish officers who suppressed the rebellion was a young lieutenant, Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna.
Historians tend to think that for a young, impressionable Santana, this becomes the basis for him of the idea of no quarter that you see carried out in the Texas Revolution.
Even with the demise of the Green Flag Republic, there were other rebellions in Texas. So the Spanish turned to diplomacy with the U.S. to see if they could save the rich territory by giving up something else, their claim to Florida. In 1819, Spanish Foreign Minister Luis de Onís and United States Secretary of State John Quincy Adams hammered out a treaty.
The Spanish thought they would be placating the United States by saying, here's Florida. In return, the Spanish thought that they would be getting a secure title to Texas.
Adams obtained Florida for the United States. Spain also dropped its claims to a section of territory on the Pacific coast. Now the United States was a transcontinental nation, stretching from sea to shining sea. On the day the treaty was signed, Adams wrote in his diary, "This is perhaps the most important day of my life." Onís believed the deal he negotiated was good as well. On paper, it was, and it all had to do with Texas.
For Spain, the signing of the Adams-Onís Treaty in 1819 put to rest the claim that the United States had any right to Texas, whether as part of the Louisiana Purchase or any other prior claims.
While the treaty locked the western border of the southern United States at the Sabine and Red Rivers, expansionist politicians demanded territory as far as the Rio Grande, claiming Texas was part of the Louisiana Purchase. However, there would be no further discussion with Spain on the matter. In February of 1821, after 11 years of fighting, Mexico obtained its independence from the rule of Madrid. The lands of independent Mexico included the rich expanse of Texas, which would develop a growing penchant for autonomy. Mexico's hold on Texas would be tested by a flood of American settlers and a potent mix of ambition and ideals that would explode at the Alamo. The story of the Alamo is, in part, a tale of early Americans on the move, pressing beyond the borders of their country and settling in Texas when it was still foreign territory. In 1821, Texas was a province in the nation of Mexico, with the ever-expanding United States right across the border. The Mexicans addressed the situation with a new immigration policy designed to transform dangerous filibustering Americans into loyal, productive Mexican citizens. It was called the impresario system, and cheap, fertile land was the bait.
An impresario is a land agent. He's the middleman between the American immigrant and the Mexican government. The sort of person he wants to attract is the hard-working, industrious, God-fearing family man, yeoman farmer, who is going to give his industry to Mexico.
The impresarios offered settlers a league of Texas land, more than 4,000 acres, for $30 on credit, no money down. The same spread in the U.S. would have cost $5,000 cash, more than most Americans would see in a lifetime.
Mexico offered the average Anglo-American immigrant more opportunity than the land of opportunity itself.
In return, Anglo-immigrants readily agreed to become citizens of Mexico and adopt Catholicism as their faith. Impresarios also stood to gain. Once the agreed-upon number of colonists had settled, the impresarios were rewarded with sizable land grants of their own, 22,000 acres for each 100 families they brought in. Stephen F. Austin was the first and most successful of the impresarios, bringing some 300 families across the border. This primitive map of his colony was said to be hand-drawn by Austin himself in 1822, at the start of his efforts. He is known today as the Father of Texas.
He doesn't come and try to impose his way on the Mexican government, but he tries to learn, how do you operate in the system? How do you make it work to your advantage? And what he was able to do was to forge friendships, genuine friendships with Mexican politicians in a non-threatening manner.
In the fertile countryside, the new settlers prospered. Rich harvests of crops and livestock turned once wild territory into thriving communities, where impresarios exercised benevolent leadership over their colonies, in harmony with the government of Mexico. But one of the impresarios, Hayden Edwards, turned to filibustering to break away from Mexico. He declared independence, naming his colony the Republic of Fredonia.
Hayden Edwards fully expects his fellow Americans to join him, but successful impresarios like Austin and successful colonists are not going to sit by and watch this bozo filibuster threaten the lives that they've made for themselves, the very successful lives. And they are keeping faith with the Mexican government that has kept faith with them.
The Fredonian Republic was quickly crushed with help from the citizens of the Austin colony. The crisis had been diffused, but other Anglos in Texas would cause trouble on their own when the issue of slavery became important to the region.
The Anglo-Americans who came to Texas in the 1820s and 1830s were primarily natives of the American side, of states that had slavery. So Texas was essentially a southern state, and therefore a state that supported slavery from its beginning.
Mexico itself abolished slavery in 1829. Slave owners in Texas were allowed to keep their slaves, but there was no assurance that would continue.
The federal government of Mexico didn't like slavery, was critical of slavery, periodically threatened slavery, threatened to do something to extinguish slavery in Texas.
It was this issue that made Mexican authorities first take notice of William Barrett Travis from America's Deep South. He came to Texas with a slave named Joe and was a militant supporter of slavery as an institution. Travis had arrived in Texas like many others, on the run from his past and searching for his future.
William Barrett Travis left Claiborne, Alabama in 1831 as a man in disgrace. He was only 22 years old, yet he was already head over heels in debt. He simply rode out of town in the night, abandoning wife, child, business, abandoning everything. And when he appeared in Texas and applied for his own grant and his own citizenship, he actually listed himself as a bachelor, pretending as if he did not have a wife back there.
Trained as an attorney, William Travis went to the town of Anahuac on Galveston Bay, a place where there were few lawyers. He opened a law practice and prospered. He also found plenty of time for romance.
He lives the life of a bachelor. With glee and sometimes exquisite detail, he describes his romantic escapades in a diary that he kept in 1833 and 1834.
A year after coming to Texas, Travis took action against Mexico's anti-slavery policy. He confronted Mexican authorities when they tried to give shelter to two runaway slaves from Louisiana.
Mexico has abolished slavery. But these old Southerners like Travis and others think this is an affront to the rights of slavery. It doesn't matter that those rights don't exist in Texas, they only exist in the United States.
Travis and his supporters openly challenged Mexican officials. The confrontation threatened to erupt in violence.
Travis and others are actually arrested by the commandant at Anahuac and incarcerated. Well, the arrest of Travis leads all to a virtual uprising of all of his friends, and they threaten to attack Anahuac, and suddenly a situation has come about in which the Mexican commander actually threatens to kill Travis if he's attacked.
Ultimately, the crisis was resolved without casualties. However, Travis spent nearly 2 months in jail. He emerged as a leader of the War Party, a militant faction in Texas, openly advocating armed conflict to break away from Mexico, and he raised troops to carry out the fight. Travis led another assault on Anahuac in June of 1835. But even at that late date, less than a year before the Alamo battle, most Anglo colonists still would not join Travis in open revolt.
He feels the anger of his fellow Texans who are basically saying, Travis, will you sit down and shut up and stop causing trouble with Mexico?
Travis alone had little effect on Mexican policy, but Mexico had combined Texas and neighboring Coahuila into one state. Impresario Stephen Austin objected and was imprisoned for 18 months, an incident that spurred Texans toward rebellion. Jim Bowie was another American who advocated war for Texas independence. He was 39 years old at the time of the Alamo. Bowie was a Kentucky adventurer who, like many Alamo defenders, came to Texas to escape from his past. But even in the sometimes rough company of the Texians, Bowie's background was extraordinary.
There's no question that James Bowie was a large-scale criminal. Everything he was doing was against the law.
Bowie's scheme was an outgrowth of the Louisiana Purchase. The United States had announced it would honor land grants issued by Spain while Louisiana had been a Spanish possession. Bowie forged literally hundreds of Spanish land grants, awarding himself vast stretches of prime riverfront land.
James Bowie was involved in land grant fraud on almost an industrial scale. Had he succeeded, he'd have been the largest private landowner in America and probably the first millionaire west of the Mississippi.
However, misspellings, repeat signatures, and other errors alerted officials that Bowie's documents were suspect. Investigations were opened, claims rejected. Court cases against Bowie under the fraudulent names he used filled newspaper pages. As the news tightened, Jim Bowie began to look at Texas as a place of refuge and opportunity.
All of his land fraud schemes in Louisiana and Arkansas exposed, Bowie himself facing probably someday an eventual indictment for fraud, Texas was simply a new board on which to play his old game. Yet he wound up getting caught up in it and becoming a Texian patriot.
Bowie was far more than a white-collar criminal. He was famous for the wide-bladed knife that bore his name. And by all accounts, he was a natural leader, a loyal friend, and a man of astonishing bravery. He and a small group of friends once faced a large Indian war party in the Texas wilderness. Bowie and company poured accurate fire from a sheltered position for 13 hours, claiming they killed 30 or 40 before the Indians finally gave up the fight. It became part of the Bowie legend across Texas and elsewhere.
It was well known in Texas because it was a local event, and it got rather well known in the East thanks to the fact that Bowie's brother Reason wrote an article about it that appeared in Philadelphia's Saturday Evening Post.
Bowie embraced his new home in Texas and accepted Mexican citizenship. At a well-appointed home in San Antonio known as the Veramendi Palace, he married the daughter of the state's vice governor. In the end, Bowie's personal qualities seem to have outweighed his reckless criminality.
You find many accounts of people who don't like what James Bowie did in his own time, but you rarely find an account of someone who didn't like the man himself.
But the man most Americans identify with the Alamo is probably David Crockett, more commonly known as Davy. He was a charismatic Tennessee hunter whose ability to spin a yarn made him a national celebrity and helped him get elected to Congress beginning in 1827.
David Crockett really is America's first media celebrity. The newspapers were publishing stories of these fantastic adventures by David Crockett, riding a streak of lightning, taming alligators, and all the rest. The first distinctive American character is the Westerner, the frontiersman, the man in buckskins who talks in a funny dialect and lives outdoors by his wits and conquers nature. And Crockett came to epitomize all of these characters.
Legend says that Crockett could kill a bear simply by grinning at it. He had a rifle named Betsy. And his backwoods charm was so irresistible, there was talk of him running for president in 1836. That is, until he failed to get reelected to Congress in 1835.
Defeated congressional candidates are not likely to be presidential candidates the following year. And so in 1835, after his defeat, he tells his constituents, "You can go to hell, and I'll go to Texas."
With talk of a revolution in Texas, Crockett, at age 49, saw opportunity and headed west in search of a fresh start.
Tennessee had played out for Crockett, and so Texas is the next frontier. He's easily the best-known man in all of Texas when he arrives, and it becomes clearly and quickly evident to him that there might be a new political future for him out there. And if Crockett performed well in this revolution in Texas, what might be the outcome? Where might he go? Maybe he could be president of a new republic west of the Mississippi, since he could no longer have a chance of being president of one to the east.
The press kept a devoted nation informed about Crockett. On January 29, 1836, this article appeared in a New York paper. At a time when tensions in Mexican Texas were reaching a boiling point, it included a speech in which Crockett proclaimed that he would have Santa Anna's head. Less than a month later, former Congressman Davy Crockett, along with Jim Bowie, William Travis, and some 250 others, would face Santa Anna and his troops at the Alamo. In 1824, 3 years after Mexico won its independence from Spain, the new nation enacted its constitution, modeled in part on that of the United States. It set up a nation in which former Spanish provinces became states, Los Estados Unidos Mexicanos, the Mexican United States. Guadalupe Victoria was the first president, and the first to confront the Texas problem. The influx of Americans under the impresario system should have stabilized the territory, but instead, it made the Mexicans apprehensive.
There's always a concern in Mexico City that if you scratched the skin of a peaceful American colonist, what you might have just beneath the surface is a hostile filibuster. So, you know, they do have considerable justification for concern.
American designs on Texas came from Washington as well. President John Quincy Adams quietly offered Mexico $1 million for the troublesome state. Victoria turned down the money and assigned General Manuel de Mier y Terán to go to Texas and examine the state's potential for Mexico's future. There was something else as well.
The authorities in Mexico City said, look, while you're up there, keep your ear to the ground because we are a tad suspicious of the intentions of some of these Anglo colonists.
The reports Mier y Terán sent back were not encouraging.
Foreign farmers settle where it suits them and take over whatever land they desire without approval. They all go about with their constitution in their pocket, demanding their rights. The predominance of North Americans will be the cause for the Mexican Federation to lose Texas unless measures are taken.
The bottom line, in Mier y Terán's view, Mexico had created a monster.
What you have is illegal aliens, and the concern for Mexican authorities is you just have no idea how many of these people we're talking about. But we know it's in the thousands.
Pressure continued from the north. When Andrew Jackson became president, he authorized another attempt to buy Texas. This time, the price was $5 million. The mere offer was a public relations disaster.
The idea that President Jackson wanted to purchase Texas was very disturbing, because what it tended to do was to tell people in Mexico that the United States wanted parts of their country.
Mexico was determined to hold on to all of its country and passed a tough new measure to do so. Based largely on Mier y Terán's reports, it was known simply as the Law of April 6, 1830.
It's an anti-immigration law. It's an attempt to stem this demographic tidal wave that is sweeping into Texas.
The irony, of course, is that even after the Law of April 6, 1830, Americans continued to come into Texas, in this case as illegal aliens.
Mier y Terán hoped the new law would allow Mexico to benefit from the rich lands of Texas by stopping the flow of Americans so Mexicans could develop the state for themselves. But he was frustrated. After President Victoria served out his term, a chaotic succession of leaders followed, as internal political disputes sapped Mexico's ability to hold on to Texas. On July 3, 1832, the despondent Manuel de Mier y Terán took his own life. He left behind a sad letter asking, "En qué parará Texas?" What will become of Texas? Perhaps the answer was more than this loyal Mexican could bear. That same year, General Antonio López de Santa Anna entered the Alamo story when he unleashed a rebellion against then-Mexican President Anastasio Bustamante. The bloody clash was fueled by competing political ideas, the federalism of Santa Anna and the centralism of Bustamante.
Centralism, on one hand, wants the power of government centralized in Mexico City, a strong central government. The Federalists, on the other hand, are suspicious of a centralized government and believe that the power of government ought to be disseminated among the states.
One of the Texian leaders who announced support for Santa Anna was none other than William Travis.
It no doubt seems odd, but at the time, Santa Anna proclaimed himself a Federalist, one in favor of the dissemination of power, the dilution of power to the local states, which is exactly what those early Texan leaders wanted.
Santa Anna was a skilled general and a hero of Mexico's fight for independence from Spain. He himself became Mexican president in 1833, advocating federalism. But then he changed. He suspended the Constitution of 1824, now seeing federalist autonomy as a threat to the stability of Mexico and his own grip on power.
Santa Anna very quickly shifts from being a federalist to a centralist to a dictator. And so those like Travis, who had once stood behind Santa Anna, are now, of course, going to be right in front of his guns.
Santa Anna's guns would also be aimed at Tejanos, Texans of Mexican birth. Their stake in the story made them passionate supporters of federalism. They were horrified that the Constitution would be voided by the president in Mexico City.
These were Tejano descendants of the founding families who identify with Texas, loyal to the land, not to a foreign government, whether it be in Mexico City, Madrid, or Washington, D.C.
Prominent among them was Juan Seguin, member of an old established San Antonio family, a man with close ties to his Anglo neighbors, especially impresario Stephen Austin.
At one point, Austin sent his younger brother to the Seguin household in San Antonio to learn Spanish. And at the same time, Seguin sent his son Juan to Austin's colony to learn English.
Even when Santa Anna became a dictator, most Texians and Tejanos at first avoided conflict with the central government. But public opinion shifted towards war when Santa Anna allowed his soldiers 2 days of rape and rampage after brutally crushing an uprising in the Mexican state of Zacatecas. The lesson wasn't lost on the Texans. They might be next.
In Zacatecas, one of the states of Mexico, just before the Texian uprising, hundreds, maybe thousands, were put to death as part of a failed revolution.
As tensions grew, Santa Anna's soldiers marched to the Texas town of Gonzales, where the locals had been given a cannon for use against Indian raids. The troops were ordered to take it back.
It's part of the centralist plan to rein in all the spare arms that are out there.
Let's face it, now American colonists pose a much greater threat to the Mexican government than Indians.
It was October 2nd, 1835. When the Centralists arrived, the Texians hoisted a flag. The message was clear. When the day was done, the Texians still had the cannon.
It's not a battle. It's hardly even a skirmish. But shots are fired, blood is shed, and after October the 2nd, for good or ill, we're committed. We are in revolt.
The Texas Revolution had suddenly begun. Encouraged by their early success, the rebels advanced. They went to San Antonio de Bejar, where they would target the Mexican garrison that patrolled its streets. Just outside town, the same garrison maintained the Alamo as a fort. In early December of 1835, 300 Texans battled 1,200 Mexicans. In 5 days of terrifying house-to-house fighting, the sharpshooting Texans killed 200 Mexican troops, while losing only 4 of their own. The Mexicans retreated to the shelter of the Alamo, and on December 9th, surrendered. There was no vengeance. Texans disarmed their enemies and sent them back to Mexico, demanding only the promise to fight no further in the war. Rising tensions in Texas and the outbreak of armed conflict was reported in the American press. This widespread coverage would change the nature of the Alamo battle and what it stood for.
Newspapers are the CNN of the day.
San Antonio was taken by the Texians on the 6th instant by 300...
When the Texans begin revolting against Mexican rule, there are newspapers all throughout the East that are carrying the story. Newspapers in the South that are carrying the story.
Volunteers were pouring in from all parts of the United States. A large amount of military...
Others are very quick to pick up on that, and when they read this, they're very eager to go participate.
Santa Anna will find the Kentucky riflemen bad troops to contend with.
The independence movement actually starts with some of the newer arrivals, people who did not have connections with the Mexican Federation.
Independence. That is right. Nothing but entire separation from the Mexicans.
The idea was, let's have a republic. That republic may exist on its own, or it can always fall back to the United States and become one of the states.
Thousands of independence-minded Americans took up arms and marched for Texas. Many of the Texan fighters who took San Antonio de Bejar returned to their homes after the battle. Thought was given to abandoning the Alamo. As rebel forces organized under a provisional government, Jim Bowie was assigned in January 1836 to inspect the Alamo to consider demolishing the cannon ramps and other fortifications Mexican soldiers had built inside the mission. Davy Crockett arrived in February. After Bowie had concluded that the Alamo was a strategic outpost that should be manned and defended, William Travis came as well. As a leader in the war movement, he had earned the rank of lieutenant colonel in the Texan Army. He and Bowie shared command of the Alamo. As the garrison grew to about 150 men, waiting for the Mexican armies they knew would be coming. But contrary to all expectations, Santa Anna had not waited until spring to launch his counterattack. He had already gathered his soldiers and begun the grueling 600-mile forced march across Mexico's northern deserts in late December 1835.
Santa Anna loved to brag that his army suffered greatly, that they knew how to suffer. And I believe that. I believe that his soldiers knew how to suffer. He made sure they did.
As many as 500 troops were lost along the way, but the forced march paid off. Centralist soldiers arrived in San Antonio de Bejar on February 23, 1836, weeks before they were expected. The Texas rebels headed into the Alamo for safety, and the die was cast for the battle to come. The Battle of the Alamo climaxed in a fury of deadly violence in the pre-dawn hours of March 6, 1836. But that was only part of the story. Manning the Alamo were about 150 defenders, an odd mix that included Europeans and Tejanos, but the majority were Americans, most of them illegal immigrants who had arrived in Texas only weeks before the siege.
The Alamo defenders were not, most of them were not colonists, were people that had just arrived to support the war, to get some land and to get the independence and annexation of Texas to the United States. So they were not offending freedom or anything like that.
But before there was a battle at the Alamo, there was a siege. It began on February 23, 1836, when the Mexicans hung a red flag at the top of San Antonio's San Fernando Church. Visible from the Alamo, it was the flag of No Quarter, a well-recognized military signal and a blunt message from the Mexicans. Surrender now, or every last defender will be put to the sword.
It was very important to get the Alamo back because it was Mexican territory and they were illegals and people that were defying Mexican government.
Even for the Mexicans as well. They were fighting in defense of their country against an armed invasion. And here at the Alamo, they had an opportunity to break the will of this insurrection. And at this point, that's what it was, an insurrection.
The men of the Alamo responded with a defiant statement of their own. Firing a single cannon shot, the bravado of the Texans was made perfectly clear. They intended to stay and fight. The old mission was never built for military use, but its protection seemed adequate, at least at the start of the siege. About 17 cannons were scattered at various positions. Riflemen did not have the loopholes and other firing ports found in a proper fortress, but the Texans could safely lay low in the thick walls as they aimed rifles at Mexican troops, still hundreds of yards distant. As the siege began, the Texans effectively lost one of their most charismatic leaders. Jim Bowie was suddenly bedridden by illness, thought to be advanced tuberculosis. The most fearless Texian of them all would no longer be a factor at the Alamo. Command of the men fell to William Barrett Travis alone. The young lawyer from Alabama who so advocated war for Texas independence now confronted the fight of his life.
He's still only 26. A man at that age today in the United States in some places would have to show ID just to buy cigarettes. Yet he's in command of the Alamo at that age. He's come a long, long way.
Outside the walls, General Santa Anna put his cannons to work. knowing the Alamo could not be taken immediately, and that time was on his side.
Santa Anna and his officers carry out a European-style siege that takes nearly 2 weeks to complete, with the final battle being what people remember as the Battle of the Alamo.
On the first day of the siege, Mexican troops were lined up on the banks of the San Antonio River, across from the Alamo. Santa Anna's cannons slowly battered away at the walls of the fort. It was military state-of-the-art for 1836, from a man who called himself the Napoleon of the West. On February 23rd, as the siege began, Travis wrote the first of several letters that couriers sneaking out of the Alamo would carry. He addressed it to his fellow citizens and compatriots and pledged victory or death. But he also made an urgent plea for reinforcements.
They knew that they could not hold that fort indefinitely. The men of the Alamo did not want to die gloriously. They wanted to live profitably. So the deal was, we will hold this place till the rest of Texas can join us. And you can tell from every letter that Travis writes from the Alamo, every letter is a plea. Okay, guys, they're here now. We really could use your help. Now would be a good time.
Travis wrote his letters to Texas provisional government. He waited for relief, but he never received a reply. The governmental council was 100 miles away. So was the Texian military leader, General Sam Houston. There was wide disagreement on how to defend against the Mexicans, and so nothing was done at all.
Why didn't the Texians go to the assistance of the Alamo? Well, the sad fact is, and this is a part of the Alamo story that's rarely told, the Texian government that would have organized those relief efforts had fallen apart in dissension and discord.
February 25th, day 3. Santa Anna launched an infantry attack against the Alamo's south wall. The Texans, well protected in the fort, easily repulsed the raid, inflicting a number of casualties. And already Crockett proved his value, his magnetic personality inspiring the defenders to fight ferociously. As Travis wrote, the Honorable David Crockett was seen at all points, animating the men to do their duty. However, in the cold calculus of war, the day belonged to the Mexicans.
The attack on the 25th is an advance on the part of Santa Anna. He is on the Texian side of the river, and he controls the Gonzales Road.
Despite Mexican control of the roads, the Tejano patriot Juan Seguin slipped out that night with another dispatch from Travis. Again, urging other Texas communities to send reinforcements. Seguin's mission kept him away from the Alamo when the final battle took place. However, as the days passed, Alamo couriers faced increasing danger. From his newly won spot on the Texan side of the river, Santa Anna expanded his siege around the Alamo.
What he's going to do is encircle the Alamo. At least he tries to do that. Now, whether he's consciously letting courier traffic in and out in order to bring as many people as he can into the trap, we don't know.
As he strengthened his chokehold on the Alamo, Santa Anna continued his bombardment of its walls. The arcane Napoleonic art of reducing walls into piles of rubble is difficult to imagine in the 21st century, unless you design and build a full-scale fortress wall. This run of stonework approximates the height and thickness of the Alamo walls. It was built in Texas by a modern-day contractor. 30 of these 6-pound cannonballs, close to the size used by Santa Anna at the Alamo, will be fired at the test wall. The cannon is placed a little over 200 yards away, just outside the range of Texan riflemen at the Alamo. Then, the test of cannon versus wall gets underway. The
first shot hits the lower right corner, lodging more than a foot and a half inside the wall. Compared to modern explosive shells, a cannonball does little damage. That's why a siege, like that at the Alamo, took so long.
When the projectile hits the wall, you might get some broken rocks and things like that. The whole idea is over weeks, perhaps months, to break a hole in the wall. The problem is the defenders at night, when you can't see them, are filling the wall in again.
If the defenders worked through the night fixing damaged walls, they would need to sleep during the day when the cannon fire started all over again. For the sleepless Texans, it was a vicious cycle. On March 1st, day 8 of the siege, reinforcements arrived. Under cover of darkness, 32 men sneaked into the Alamo. They came from nearby Gonzales, the town where the war had started with a defiant banner and a cannon shot. The new troops, however few, gave the beleaguered Travis a glimmer of hope.
I think Travis's goal is to gather as many Texians as he can into the Alamo and at the very least, delay the army, if not defeat the army.
Altogether, as many as 100 men made it into the Alamo during the siege, bringing the garrison's strength to 250. In light of the scant reinforcements, on March 3rd, the 10th day of the siege, Travis wrote another of his letters to the outside world. But now, his defiant tone gave way to bitterness.
He says, look, I'm going to stay here, and my men are going to stay here, and we may well die here. And he said, our bones will reproach our countrymen for their neglect.
On day 12 of the siege, March 5th, Santa Anna decided to bring it to an end. He announced a time for the final assault on the Alamo, the next morning at 5 a.m. He met with his officers to lay out the plan. Soldiers were ordered to scale the Alamo walls at any cost. No prisoners were to be taken. All the Alamo defenders must die. And Santa Anna would take his breakfast inside the captured fort. On the afternoon before the final battle, Santa Anna called a halt to the artillery bombardment. For the first time in nearly 2 weeks, the ragged Alamo defenders could finally rest. But even as the Texans drifted off to sleep, Mexican soldiers quietly took their battle positions. In a few hours, both sides would rise to the call of war and fight the epic Alamo battle, making history as well as legend. The long two-week siege of the Alamo failed to inflict any casualties on the Texans. As many as 250 defenders remained inside when the final battle began quietly at 5 a.m. on March 6, 1836. In the darkness, 1,800 Mexican soldiers waited in their attack positions, just 100 yards from the Alamo walls. The Mexican artillery was silent, and inside the Alamo, weary Texans were having their first undisturbed sleep in nearly 2 weeks. Santa Anna prepared to give the command that would unleash the attack. However, in one of the few failures of Santa Anna's battle plan, an anxious soldier began to shout before the order was given.
Viva Santa Anna!
Viva la República!
The shout spread, bugles sounded, and the troops advanced. The noise caused the Mexicans to lose some of the surprise they hoped for. Within the Alamo, Texans awakened to the clamor of war. Travis rallied his men to the walls, and the fierce fighting began. Santa Anna's battle plan called for advancing columns to hit the Alamo on three sides. The smallest, 125 men, attacked the south wall. More than 400 soldiers charged in from the east. Nearly 800 attacked the north wall in the northwest corner. Inside the walls, Jim Bowie remained on his sickbed. he was too ill to take part in the fighting at all. Davy Crockett led a group of defenders at the Alamo's south wall, successfully fending off the Mexican attack there. William Travis rushed to the north wall with his slave Joe fighting alongside him. A moment later, Travis was dead. He had been a leader in the movement to fight for Texas independence. Now, his war was over.
It's Joe who sees his master go down with a bullet to the head. But after that, Joe later says that he simply goes and hides and takes no further part in the actual battle itself, since he doesn't really have a stake in it. Regardless of who wins, he's still a slave. Joe simply looks out for himself.
Though Travis was killed early in the battle, the Alamo defenders fought on without their commander. Skilled Texan riflemen mounted the walls, pouring fire on the Mexicans as fast as they could. Cannons loaded with rusty chains, nails, and other scraps pounded the invading columns with deadly effect. And for a time, the attack stalled. But Santa Anna had 400 fresh soldiers in reserve, and he sent them against the north wall. Now the sheer force of numbers overwhelmed the Texans as Mexican troops neared the top.
No military plan survives contact with the enemy. Santa Anna is no different. But his plan must have been somewhat solid, as well as his preparation, because it only takes a half hour once the attack has commenced for the Mexicans to breach the Alamo's defenses.
Those defenses were nothing more than the Alamo's thick walls, which now proved fatal to the Texan riflemen. With the Mexicans on the ground below, the Texans had to stand up to fire their rifles, making them easy targets for enemy muskets. Another problem for the Texans was the sheer size of the Alamo. Its perimeter walls stretched a quarter of a mile. If the defenders were stationed evenly around the compound, there would be only one every 7 feet, a mere 33 on the north wall. But the Mexicans had more than a numerical advantage. The American version of the Alamo story often overlooks the professionalism of Santa Anna's army, perhaps the battle's most important factor.
Texians brought a knife to a gunfight, and the Mexican army has been very active for about the past 18 months. They know what they're doing. It's a tough army to beat.
Soon after the north wall defenses collapsed, the west wall was breached, and Mexican soldiers poured into the Alamo from two sides. The surviving Texans fell back to their second line of defense, the long barracks on the east side of the Alamo. Outside, in the courtyard, Mexican soldiers discovered the Alamo defenders had neglected to disable the fort's artillery. It was a costly error. The invading troops turned the Texans' own cannons back toward the long barracks. What should have been a refuge became a death trap. A few Texans inside the barracks waved white flags of surrender, but other Texans had no intention of surrendering and continued to fire. Taking fire under a white flag, the Mexicans were enraged and rushed inside to finish the job with pistols and bayonets, killing everyone, taking no prisoners. Eventually, they came upon Jim Bowie.
One Mexican account we have that deals with his death says that he was found hiding under a blanket. The Mexicans thought he was hiding. In fact, he was probably too sick to get up from his blanket. And so his death was not so much a death in battle as a simple execution.
Jim Bowie died from several gunshots to the head. He was a man whose bravery and personal magnetism helped rally support to the Texas war movement. But his death was far from glorious. Davy Crockett was said to be among the last to fall. Though whether he died fighting or was executed is a matter still open to question. There was killing outside the Alamo as well. Some 40 to 60 Texans made a dash for safety, but were cut down by Santa Anna's waiting cavalry. By 6:30 a.m., only an hour and a half after Santa Anna's final attack had begun, the battle was over. Dawn revealed a surreal landscape of broken bodies and smoking ruins. The Tejanos, the Europeans, the American volunteers, the Gonzales 32 were dead. Like most wars, the Alamo battle was drenched in the blood of its soldiers and uplifted by their sacrifice. But it's not known exactly how many died on either side. Few conflicts, in fact, come to us so draped in mystery, twisted by distortions and riddled with questions. How did Davy Crockett really die? Was Santa Anna's victory more costly than defeat? And is the true story of the Alamo still waiting to be found? The distortion of Alamo history began even before the smoke had lifted from the battlefield. With the fighting ended, Santa Anna dictated a letter to his Secretary of War in which he boasted of killing 600 Alamo defenders.
Santana inflates the number of Alamo slain to a ridiculously high level. In fact, his private secretary, Ramon Caro, later says, well, I knew this was ridiculous when I wrote it, but what are you going to do? He's the president of Mexico. He gives me the number. He says, write it. So we know that Santana's numbers are not right.
Other, more objective Mexican sources put the number at around 250, a figure most historians accept as accurate. Many of the names of the Texan dead are inscribed on a monument in San Antonio, known as the Alamo Cenotaph. Only 189 have been identified. The others are the unknown soldiers of the battle.
And we desperately would like to know the names. We probably will never know the names of all the men who died inside the Alamo.
The Mexican losses have also been distorted in some accounts of the story.
The numbers of Mexican casualties have been inflated to ridiculous levels in some pretty authoritative sources. Some people cite them as high as 1,500 casualties. That's ridiculous.
Part of the reason we have so many different figures is the winner gets to write the history, and ultimately the Texians win the Texas Revolution.
So uncertain is the information that even professional historians do not agree on the Mexican dead.
Known casualties number between 521 and 550. Santa Anna lost approximately half of the assault force.
At the end of the day, on March 6th, there are 60 soldados that were killed. Now you can double that figure probably and come up with the number of wounded, and then a percentage of those would have been mortally wounded. So the Texians, contrary to what a lot of Texans would like to believe, did not wreak that much damage on their enemy.
Another element of the Alamo story that elevates it to mythic status is the popular misconception that everyone in the Alamo was killed. A few women and children who lived in some Alamo buildings were inside the walls and hid during the battle. They were not part of the defending garrison and were spared by the Mexicans, but a number of other people lived as well. Another survivor was Travis's slave, Joe, who was returned to Travis's family in the United States. But on the one-year anniversary of the battle, he escaped. A reward for his return was offered by the executor of Travis's estate. But Joe stayed hidden for the next 40 years.
That's a long period of a man's life simply to disappear. But then he was just Joe. We don't even know what last name he had, if he had one, or what last name he would have chosen to use, which makes it very possible for him simply to fall through the cracks of all the records.
Joe resurfaced briefly in Austin, Texas, when a local newspaper mentioned him in an 1877 article about the Texas War. Nothing more was said, however, and he disappeared once again. Soon after the Alamo fell, rumors circulated of defenders who may have survived. 20 days after the battle, the Arkansas Gazette reported about two who lived. Perhaps they had managed to elude Santa Anna's cavalry outside the Alamo. However, neither their names nor the specifics of their stories were included, and so the two have vanished into history. The Alamo survivor who is known by name is Brigido Guerrero, one of the Tejanos who fought in the battle. His name is assigned to a tract of land, one of many Texas granted to veterans of its war for independence. But Guerrero is the only such veteran to receive his grant for surviving the Alamo. Guerrero's original claim is well over a century old and must be handled with care. It is preserved in the archives of Bexar County, where the Alamo is located.
Your petitioner, Brigido Guerrero, of the county of Bexar, state of Texas, respectfully represents that he was one of those who entered the Alamo under Colonel Travis in February of 1836, that he was one of the defenders of that place, that he remained there up to the last moment, and that when after the storming of the place by the Mexican army, he saw that there was no hope left, he had the good fortune of saving his life by concealing himself.
At the Texas General Land Office in Austin, researchers have uncovered records identifying another possible survivor. His name is Henry Warnell. A 500-acre plot of land, the long shaded rectangle on this computerized map, was originally granted to Henry Warnell's son, based on Henry's Alamo service. All but one of the documents in Warnell's file say he was killed at the Alamo. The one letter that says Warnell survived claims he died soon after the battle, 140 miles away at Port Lavaca on the Gulf Coast. However, Port Lavaca didn't yet exist when the Alamo fell. The author of the letter, one Henry Anderson, appears nowhere else in early Texas history. Who he was and why he wrote the letter, nobody knows. Could Henry Warnell have been one of the two survivors reported in the Arkansas newspaper? Like so much else about the Alamo, the Warnell case remains a mystery. Perhaps no aspect of the Alamo story has been mythologized more than the deaths of its three most celebrated heroes, William Travis, Jim Bowie, and Davy Crockett. Though Travis was among the first to die, some newspapers reported that he had actually stabbed himself rather than be captured. Historians generally agree that Jim Bowie was sick with tuberculosis and helpless during the March 6th assault. Nevertheless, popular legend has Bowie fighting back, a story that originated in a newspaper interview with his mother.
You have the mother of James Bowie, who replies that knowing her son James, he probably sat up in bed and killed at least 20 or 30 Mexicans with his Bowie knife. She said it, his mother in Louisiana.
Perhaps not surprisingly, it is Davy Crockett's death that has soared to the greatest mythic heights. From the very first news accounts in 1836, through later paintings, books, and movies, Davy Crockett embodied the Alamo spirit of defiance and sacrifice.
If you talk about popular belief in the late 20th century, then it's certainly that set by the Disney version of 1955, you know, Davy Crockett swinging his rifle, one of the last to go down fighting at the Alamo.
Increasingly, however, historians are beginning to suspect that Crockett was actually captured alive at the Alamo and then executed. The story was told just that way by a Texan sergeant named Frank Dolson.
As far as I'm concerned, the best evidence we have as to how Davy Crockett died comes from something that's usually referred to as the Dolson letter. Dolson was asked to serve as interpreter during the debriefing of a Mexican officer. According to Dolson, the Mexican officer witnessed the execution of prisoners following the Battle of the Alamo, and one of these prisoners was Davy Crockett.
In the debriefing, the unnamed officer said that immediately after the Alamo battle, a Mexican general named Castrillon had taken six American prisoners. As the prisoners were brought forward, the informant happened to be standing next to another officer, Colonel Juan Almonte.
Juan Almonte was We know from letters he was writing from New Orleans in 1834 that he was aware of who Davy Crockett was. And according to Dolson's informant, Almonte says, the man behind there among the prisoners, that's the famous David Crockett.
The informant said that Santa Anna had angrily refused Castrillon's request to spare the prisoners' lives. They were executed on the spot. Dolson included the remarkable story in a letter to his brother, which was eventually published in a Detroit newspaper. A similar account of the execution that also mentions Crockett by name appeared in the diary of a Mexican officer named José Enrique de la Peña.
According to de la Peña, other soldiers stepped forth from the ranks of Santa Anna's retinue and killed these men with sword thrusts. Not immediate death, but a slow, difficult death with repeated sword thrusts. And the men died, according to de la Peña, moaning, but without humiliating themselves before their captors.
The execution scenario seems hard for many people to accept. For them, Davy Crockett's death while fighting is far more heroic than a brutal execution. But do these apparent facts really diminish Crockett and the others who were put to the sword?
Think about it. What happened during World War II? Korea, Vietnam, or Desert Storm, or Iraq? When you have somebody who is overwhelmed, taken, and then they're executed, does that make them any less of a hero? Of course not.
The dead Alamo defenders became folk heroes almost instantly, at least in the American version of the story. As the war for Texas independence continued, the death of the Alamo martyrs provided the passion that would lead the Texans to victory. Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna was the victor of the Battle of the Alamo, a military hero to the nation of Mexico. He had risen to the pinnacle of power. But in lacking mercy for the vanquished, he suffered a fatal flaw. He gave no quarter at the battle and burned rather than buried the bodies of the Alamo's dead. Santa Anna hoped to crush the spirit of rebellious Texans in other parts of the state. The effect was just the opposite.
By insisting on killing every single combatant, he made it a last stand that inspired rather than depressed. Who's responsible for the moral power of the Alamo? Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna.
That moral power is embodied in the often repeated battle cry, "Remember the Alamo." With it came the indignation that fueled the rebellion. The Texas War of Independence was now in full force. During the Alamo siege, delegates meeting 100 miles away at a town called Washington on the Brazos had signed a Texas Declaration of Independence and formed a government. The Texas Army was officially placed under command of General Sam Houston. Houston was once the governor of Tennessee, a protege of Andrew Jackson, and an activist in Texas politics from the time he first arrived in 1832. As Santa Anna's troops fanned out after the Battle of the Alamo, General José Urrea approached from the south. Near the town of Goliad, 75 miles from San Antonio de Bejar, Urrea's army captured nearly 350 Texan troops. Prisoners were held inside their own headquarters, the old Spanish fort called Presidio La Bahia, which was established as a Texan outpost in 1749. The rebels nursed their wounds and remained in captivity for a week. Under Mexican law, they were considered pirates. And though Urrea had standing orders to execute them all, he appealed to Santa Anna to spare the men. Santa Anna would not budge. Mexican soldiers marched the Texans out of their fort and opened fire on the unarmed men. Even the wounded were shot, and nearly all the prisoners were killed, including their commander, James W. Fannin. To the Texans, the war became a blood feud.
Remember Goliad now joined Remember the Alamo as a battle cry. For Santa Anna, it was just another step toward the heart of the Texas Revolution.
Santa Anna's goal is, yes, to take down the Alamo, to take down Goliad, and destroy those fortifications. But his objective is the center of gravity, is the Texian government in the interior of the colonies.
Santa Anna learned that the Texas government was on the run, that Sam Houston's army of 900 men was encamped on the San Jacinto River. There, the final battle of the Texas Revolution would take place. Among Houston's men was the Tejano Juan Seguin of San Antonio de Bejar, the man who carried messages out of the Alamo before it fell. Seguin had raised his own unit of Tejanos to fight against Mexico. Houston was afraid his Texians might mistake the Tejanos for Mexican enemies. So Seguin's men identified themselves with tags in their hats, eager to proclaim, "Recuerden el Alamo," remember the Alamo. On April 21st, 1836, 1,200 Mexican troops were at rest in their tents when Houston's army attacked. Santa Anna was confident, and his sentries failed to spot the approaching Texans.
Santa Anna certainly has very little respect for the Texans, whom he considers pirates, and those who hold their enemy in contempt are liable to get in trouble. The classic case is the Battle of San Jacinto.
The Texans charged, so surprising the enemy that the battle was a rout. 600 Mexicans were killed.
By the time the Texan fighters got to San Jacinto, they were determined to win, not to be taken captive, and you have to say, to take their share of vengeance as well.
It was the only battle Santa Anna's army lost after the Alamo, but it was the only battle that mattered.
And Santa Anna handles the campaign up to a point very well, but he ultimately loses in a disaster. Based on the end result at San Jacinto, he's certainly no Napoleon. He's something of the West, but it isn't Napoleon.
Santa Anna was captured the next day. Some Texans wanted to lynch him. A wounded Sam Houston held them back. In exchange for his life and his freedom, Santa Anna signed what is known as the Treaty of Velasco, requiring him to recognize Texan independence.
In the Texas Revolution, the battle that gets the most attention, of course, is going to be the Alamo. But if it had not been for the battle at San Jacinto, where the Centralist forces, where Santa Anna's forces were defeated, we wouldn't remember the Alamo, because the war would have been a successful Mexican campaign to put down a rebellious state, and Texas would have remained part of Mexico.
Santa Anna later led his country's troops against Americans in the Mexican War of 1848, losing even more lands in Texas, plus huge territories now comprising most of the western United States. He remained active in politics for 20 years after the Alamo. But ultimately, Mexico tired of Santa Anna. He spent his last days in a squalid residence before dying penniless at 84 in the year 1876.
He was a living embarrassment and at the same time the scapegoat for everything that had gone wrong in Mexican history.
But history on the other side of the border began to change as Texas became part of the United States, and the American version of the Alamo story took on a life of its own.
Okay, I'm back. We will be going into very detailed analysis of large portions of what you heard tonight, as well as other things. I tell you, that Mexican woman they had commenting in there, they use her in a documentary on the Mexican-American War on PBS and on the History Channel. I just want to slap that bitch silly. Now, I understand her own nationalism, but most of what she says about the Texans and as well as the United States is just outright lies. And I will be playing portions of her comments at later points in this series, and I will clarify her lies. In this instance, she was partially right in the sense that there was a large segment of the Texans that had freshly come from the United States to fight, but it was not like most of them were, according to the way she described it. Additionally, most of the people in Texas, living in Texas at that time, as well as people participating in the Revolution, had been in Texas for at least 10 years. Some a little less, some a little longer. But there were American volunteers who did come in to help fight the Revolution. But nevertheless, we'll get to that coming up over a period of time. Now, I was looking at the time, see how much time we got left. And depending on how long the show goes, you never know when Blog Talk Radio is going to cut you off after 2 hours. And I was thinking, what could I play at this point? What I'm going to do is I'm going to play a song, and then I'm going to play a short documentary on one of the founding fathers of Texas. And we're going to go into more detail on founding fathers of Texas at a later point. Essentially, William Barrett Travis, James Bowie, Stephen F. Austin, Sam Houston. Crockett really wasn't so much of a founding father of Texas, but you know, he was one of the ones who did show up at the last minute. But you know, we want to go ahead and discuss him. And as this documentary said, he probably was the most famous person at that time. However, Sam Houston was very well known as well. And I will be playing some more things about him, as well as when we get into the nitty-gritty of all this, go over some things about his life. He was a pretty interesting character as well. And he and Crockett both had potential to become presidents of the United States and essentially blew it. So, but anyway, let me go ahead and play this song here. And this is by Buck Owens. Hopefully that rings a bell with some of you, the older folks that might. He was a co-host on Hee Haw, the Hee Haw Variety Hour, that came out in the 1960s and may have even run into the early 70s. I think it did run into the early 70s as well. And of course, he had a singing career before he ever went on Hee Haw, and he is from Texas. And I'm going to play a song that he did that the Beatles did a cover of, and I'll be right back.
Well, I'll bet you I'm gonna be a big star.
Okay. Yeah, hee-haw. He co-starred with Roy Clark. And some of you are old enough to remember that. Hager Brothers, Minnie Pearl, Grandpa Jones, a whole slew of people that... It's like they rounded up everybody in the country music business for that show. But it was funny at the time. But anyway, let's see here. I've got three short documentaries, and I don't have them labeled as to who is who, and I don't rightly remember which one is which. I've got it labeled Fathers of Texas Part 1, Fathers of Texas Part 2, Fathers of Texas Part 3. One is Stephen F. Austin, one is Sam Houston, and one is David Crockett. But I don't remember which one of these are which. So, I'm just going to pick one. I'm going to try and pick the Davy Crockett one. Because I've got a lot more to add on Sam Houston. And I kind of want to get his all together if I can. Kind of do it all at once. Before I do that, though, I wanted to mention, I guess the next show that I do in this series, I'll put a pic of a climate map up of the United States that kind of gives you an idea of the temperatures and humidity over the contiguous 48, you know, and basically on this map it shows the whole South as being humid, you know. Now in Texas, the further west you get, the drier it gets, and the further north you get, the drier it gets. But, you know, for the most part, until, you know, unless you get way out west or way up north, you know, there's humidity here. And so, you know, that's one thing that if you're not used to, then, you know, you come down here during the summer, you're going to sweat if you're outside. But, you know, most people go from one point of air conditioning to the other. And, you know, you do that for a few months, and, you know, winter comes along, and, you know, about two-thirds of the year is comfortable. And the other third, well, you know, you go outside and you sweat a little bit, it's good for you, you know. But anyway, let me see if I can get the Davy Crockett one to come up. We'll see what happens. And this one is about 15 minutes. And after that, I'll play another song and close out the show.
Fathers of Texas will continue in a moment here on A&E.
The bargain Stephen Austin set for his settlers in Texas was unbeatable. A huge grant of free land for all newcomers, and a plan to redeem this land from its wilderness state. But in the face of advancing Mexican forces, how would a fugitive diplomat rally the strength it would take to keep his people and their way of life truly free? The answer was Sam Houston.
The morning of glory is dawning upon us. The work of liberty has begun. Sam Houston, 1835.
In the autumn of 1835, Houston would sell 4,000 acres of his Red River land to raise money to buy such necessities as a uniform with a general star on it and a sword and a sash to adorn it.
War is raging on the frontiers. The enemy must be driven from our soil, or desolation will accompany their march upon us. Independence is declared. It must be maintained. The patriots of Texas are appealed to in behalf of their bleeding country. Sam Houston, March 2nd, 1836.
Houston's small volunteer army assembled near San Antonio, and with Santa Anna's troops advancing into Texas, he traced a retreat that would bring the armies face to face at a bayou battlefield called San Jacinto.
Houston's camp was set up on Buffalo Bayou, and Santa Anna's camp was about a mile away, and these two armies were set up there, and Santa Anna's feeling was that he could just pick off the Texans whenever he chose.
Houston camped at San Jacinto and slept far into the next morning.
Houston held a council of war at noon. According to Houston's account, most of the soldiers didn't want to fight or didn't want to attack. But Houston decided to fight that afternoon, formed his army into a line across the field at San Jacinto at 3:30 in the afternoon of April 21st, and advanced on the Mexican position.
The rebels advance on the Mexican barricades, screaming like banshees their battle cry, "Remember the Alamo, remember Goliad." Flustered, disoriented, the Mexicans began to fall back, first as individuals, but then as entire squads.
For 18 minutes, blood and carnage ruled the battlefield at San Jacinto.
I sat there on my horse, and I shot them until my ammunition gave out. Then I turned the butt into my musket and started knocking them in the head. Private William Young.
The Mexicans fired one volley, most of which went over the head of the Texans. Although that's when Houston was hit and his force was hit. The Texans then advanced to maybe 20 yards away. They fired and then charged and broke through.
All discipline was at an end. We fired as rapidly as we could. As soon as we had fired, each man reloaded, and he who got his gun ready first moved on without waiting for orders. Private Alfonso Steele, 1836.
The Texans are in an absolute killing frenzy of revenge and fall upon many of the Mexican soldados, some of whom beg for their lives, yelling, "Me no Alamo, me no Goliad." That finds them little mercy. Most of the Mexicans actually fall back into a marsh area, into a lake. By the end of the day, the Peggy Lake is completely crammed full of Mexican bodies, and the waters of Peggy Lake are thoroughly red.
They had plunged into the mire and water with horses and mules. Everyone who seemed likely to escape soon received a ball from the murderous aim of a practiced rifleman, and the bayou was literally bridged over with carcasses of dead mules, horses, and men. Sam Houston, 1836.
The wounded General Houston rested on the battlefield until a mud-spattered Santa Ana was brought before him, defeated.
I was lying on my side in kind of a daze when I felt some person clasp my right hand. I looked up as Santa Anna stood before me. He announced his name and rank.
Houston emerged the celebrated hero of San Jacinto and the founder of a new republic that needed a president.
In the campaign for the presidency of the new Republic of Texas, Sam Houston and Stephen F. Austin are both seemingly reluctant candidates, although Houston certainly much less reluctantly than Austin. And Houston wins overwhelmingly. He's the George Washington of Texas. He's the great military hero, and he wins an impressive and important victory.
Houston named Stephen Austin Secretary of State, but the frail founder of the Texan colonies would not live to harvest the fruits of liberty.
Austin had been plagued with ill health all of his adult life. He was a chronic sufferer from malaria, which weakened his entire body. The year in a damp dungeon in Mexico City had further weakened his constitution. And in the closing months of 1836, Austin found himself living in a drafty log cabin under a heavy workload as Secretary of State of the new republic, and he contracted pneumonia. He didn't even have a bed to lie in. He took to a pallet on the cold, drafty floor and died a couple of days later.
On December 29th, 1836, a procession including Sam Houston and many of the original colonists looked on as the paddle ship Yellowstone carried Austin's body on its final journey up the Brazos River.
A successful military chieftain is hailed with admiration and applause, and monuments perpetuate his fame. But the bloodless pioneer of the wilderness, like the corn and cotton he causes to spring where it never grew before, attracts no notice. No slaughtered thousands or smoking cities attest his devotion to the cause of human happiness, and he is regarded by the mass of the world as a humble instrument to pave the way for others. Stephen Fuller Austin.
Austin's work in his new republic were left unfinished, for the dream he shared with Houston was of a Texas conjoined with the United States.
Both Sam Houston and Stephen F. Austin were dedicated to having Texas become part of the United States once the victory had been won at San Jacinto. But it proved more difficult than they thought. Anti-slavery sentiment in the North blocked annexation.
As a result, Houston would finish his first term as president with his proposals to annex Texas to the United States rejected. The 45-year-old hero would briefly retire from public life to pursue, among other interests, a young woman named Margaret.
Fathers of Texas will continue in a moment here on Fathers of Texas.
It was 1839. The new Republic of Texas would celebrate its third birthday and Sam Houston his 46th. During his brief retirement from public life, Sam would visit Alabama and favor a young woman with an Italian courtship cameo of himself. The object of the general's affections was 20-year-old Margaret Moffett Lee.
Margaret was the woman that Houston had been looking for all of his life. The good woman that all of his friends said that Sam needed to help him settle down. And settle him down, Margaret did.
Margaret Moffett Lee succeeded in sobering him up. He'd had a terrible drinking problem, and she did succeed in drying him out. But her greatest crusade, really, to get him to join the Baptist Church and to be baptized.
She brought a tremendous amount of stability to Sam's life. I think an awful lot of love. Their correspondence is extremely, extremely, I think the right word would be mushy, though not untypical for this period.
My ever dear love, I love you so much that I am not happy when you are absent from me. I trust you will be with me soon so that I will reserve the rest for your own private ear. It is much safer to whisper things than write them. If I were to tell you here how much I love you and the letter should be opened by some other person, there would be an awful disclosure. Thine forever, Margaret Lee Houston.
Late in life, Houston and Margaret have a number of children. Houston seems to love his children, be devoted to them. His letters are replete with references to them.
My dearest, you have around you many of the pleasures which I so much desire. Thy faithful husband, Houston.
Among the objects of Houston's pleasure were Nanny, Mary Willie, and Maggie, named for her mother. Like her namesake, Maggie would someday wear the cameo that conveyed Sam's likeness and affection. Settling in Huntsville, Texas, the Houston flock would grow to number 8 children, including Sam Jr. and Andrew Jackson Houston, named for his father's military and political mentor.
But the fact of the matter is, Sam's first love is politics, and he spends far more time in Washington or Austin than in Huntsville with his children.
After 2 terms as president of the new republic, Sam Houston saw Texas annexed to the United States in 1845. To make way for the stars and stripes of the Union, the Lone Star flag of Texas was lowered and the Republic of Texas was no more. Sam Houston would continue as senator.
Houston served in the Senate from 1846 to 1859. For most of that time, the great question facing the United States was a sectional dispute between the North and the South that eventually broke up the nation and led to civil war. From the beginning of that question, Sam Houston was a unionist, an all or nothing unionist.
In 1854, as one of the 2 U.S. senators from Texas, Houston performed the bravest political act of his career when he voted against the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which would have potentially opened up certain western territories to slavery. So he, alone among all U.S. senators from the cotton states, voted against the act, and of course he was hung in effigy, he was reviled on street corners and on the political stump. The state legislature called upon him to resign in Texas.
Although rejected by the Texas legislature, the people remained loyal to Houston and elected him governor in 1859.
It was a very special case, and it was a testimonial to Houston's tremendous popularity as a military hero. He became governor in 1859. He was then governor when Lincoln was elected in 1860 and the secession movement began. Houston fought secession in Texas exactly the same way he had fought the San Jacinto campaign against the Mexicans.
Hardly had Texas joined the Union when the issue of secession to maintain the right to hold slaves swept the southern states.
Houston fought with all of his might against the forces of secession and disunion. But crowds now hooted him down, spat upon him, threatened his life. The man who had given birth to Texas was now hated by the people he had led. He refused to swear allegiance to the Confederacy and was ousted from office.
In the weeks and months leading up to him finally being removed as the governor of Texas, when he would go out to public speaking engagements, people actually stood on the side and individuals would chant, "Kill him, kill him, kill him."
Houston is terribly unpopular with the great majority of Texans at this point for having opposed secession. At one point, threats are made against his life. But an old friend, and Houston had hundreds of them in Texas, pulled a revolver and said, "I don't agree with what General Houston has done either, but as long as he's Sam Houston, he can speak anywhere on the streets of Texas and his life is safe."
Houston retired to Huntsville, Texas, where he lived his last years secluded in a house that looked like a steamboat. By late 1863, his eyesight and health were failing him. He reposed to the front room of the steamboat house, where he would receive his last visitors and spend final days with Margaret.
As he lay dying in the steamboat house, his final thoughts were of Texas, as were his final words. As Margaret read to him from a prayer book, he gasped out, "Texas, Texas, Margaret."
Okay, well, we got Houston instead of Crockett. Yeah, Houston is a character. I've got more information on him. He was also governor of Tennessee. He also served in Congress for Tennessee. No one else in this country has served governor and all the positions that he held during their lifetime. And he has the record on that. He was also a very strange character in a lot of ways. And by the way, going to the Battle of San Jacinto, I've got reports that say almost the exact opposite. His men wanted to go, but he did not. But who knows which is right. But I've got a very detailed report that I'm going to read on that. And, of course, you know, that's the father, one of the fathers of Texas. I'm going to give a fair assessment to all this. He was a protege of Andrew Jackson. He was a friend of his. He fought in the Battle of Horseshoe Bend against the Creek Indians in the Red Stick War. He actually led the charge. He was wounded in that battle as well as the Battle of San Jacinto. Davy Crockett fought in the Creek War as well. I don't remember which one, but it was not at Horseshoe Bend. Crockett was in the militia of Tennessee, but his service with the militia there was very short. Crockett seems to get the most notoriety, but Houston was just as much of a character as well. Houston was an Indian agent to the Cherokee for Andrew Jackson, and Houston had run away from home because he didn't like farming. He didn't like working in the family store either, and so he spent a portion of his childhood living with the Cherokee Indians. And he had a drinking problem. So, but anyway, there will be a lot more detail on him coming up. He is certainly does not get the notoriety that he should get in history for all of his accomplishments. And he and Crockett were certainly the first celebrities, you know, as they described Crockett in that earlier documentary. It wasn't just Crockett, it was Houston, too. And like I said, both of them had a chance to become president of the United States, and both of them blew it. So I'm going to play a song, and I'll try to get the next show in as quickly as I can. Can't know just yet. doing all kinds of other stuff here, and this is just one part of it. So we're going to go out with some Stevie Ray Vaughan, Voodoo Child. This is probably the best version of it that I have heard. Until next time.
I'm